Coming up on Fronteras, deportation policy is often defined in the numbers deported. Only recently has there been research looking into the impact on children, something teachers and social workers already know.
Fear and physical pain and headaches, stomach aches.
A report on how the deportation of family members can impact the mental health of young people. And conservationists in the southwestern border region are busy this time of year cleaning trash out of watersheds before winter rains hit. By involving the community, they hope to create allies in the fight for a healthy border environment.
I believe that if people are not experiencing it, they're also not going to advocate for it.
That story coming up. First, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio will have a court-appointed monitor watching over his department. From Phoenix, Al Macias reports this is the result of a six-year legal battle over a racial discrimination case against the sheriff's department.
Judge Murray Snow ruled in May that the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department had singled out Latinos for traffic stops. The court stepped in after attorneys representing the plaintiffs and the sheriff couldn't work out an agreement that would uphold the court's order to end discriminatory practices. The ruling calls for a monitor to oversee the agency's retraining of deputies, create a community advisory board that will meet three times a year, and the department must install audio and video recording devices in patrol vehicles. ACLU attorney Dan Pakoda, who represented some of the plaintiffs, says this will help.
For every vehicle stop, there's a significant amount of information that has to be collected. It has been found throughout the country that local law enforcement has a necessary, not necessarily sufficient, but a necessary first step to reduce and deter the use of race in law enforcement decisions is to have sufficient data collection.
For his part, Sheriff Arpaio had strongly opposed a monitor and the community advisory board, but his attorney Tom Liddy says the sheriff still controls the department.
Will there be changes? There'll be changes in training. They'll have a monitor that will review some things. Some things will go to the court, sometimes under seal, sometimes not. But the actual policing on the ground is not going to change.
Sheriff Arpaio's department will have to comply with the court order for three straight years before it can emerge from the court oversight. In Phoenix, Al Macias reporting.
Trash is a major problem in the U.S.-Mexico border region. These last dry months of the year in Southern California bring a flurry of cleanup efforts in the Tijuana River Valley, which begins in Mexico and flows into the Pacific Ocean on the U.S. side. From our Fronteras desk, Jill Replogle reports on work underway to put that trash to use while enticing people to discover and care for the border region's shared natural resources.
Borderfield State Park occupies some 400 acres in the very southwestern corner of the continental U.S. The entrance to the park isn't exactly inviting. There's an empty dirt lot for parking and a gate that's usually closed. But a project is underway to make the park more welcoming, using trash collected from the adjacent Tijuana River Valley and estuary.
These are all bottles that we actually sourced these out of the canyon right upstream.
Stephen Wright is co-founder of the organization Four Walls International. Four Walls takes trash found in the border region and repurposes it as construction materials. Right now, he's leveling off a row of plastic soda bottles embedded in a layer of wet concrete.
About 70% of the trash that's in the river we can repurpose in this manner.
This trash will eventually become a bench for park visitors. Park director Chris Peregrin takes me to a stash of plastic bottle building blocks. They're all stuffed full of plastic bags and pieces of discarded foam.
You look at this foam, those little particles, this just splits and breaks and gets smaller and smaller and disperses through the environment and gets embedded in the riparian habitat and the salt marsh and then ultimately is making its way out to the ocean.
The work here to improve the park entrance is funded by a grant from the San Diego Community Foundation. And it's not just about building things with trash. It's part of a larger effort to improve the border environment in the U.S. and in Mexico and to involve the people who stand to benefit from cleaner water and a healthier Tijuana River Valley. Peregrine, the park director, says September and October are prime cleanup months here because soon the rains will come, bringing trash, polluted water, and sediment from illegal dumps and construction sites in Tijuana. From then until spring, people usually can't even get into the park because trails and roads get flooded, and the waters are often too toxic to do cleanup.
As a result, a large section of the community is not getting the experience of this river valley. And I believe that if people are not experiencing it, they're also not going to advocate for it.
South of the border, in the Playas de Tijuana neighborhood, dozens of people are cleaning up an abandoned park that stretches along a narrow canyon feeding into the Tijuana estuary across the border. The workers are employed through a temporary work program run by Mexico's equivalent of the Environmental Protection Agency. Here, too, Four Walls International is turning trash into park amenities. The U.S. EPA is supporting the project. This is one of my guides, Ana Aguiarte. Tijuana doesn't have many green areas or places to recreate, she says. And the idea is to preserve this area, to recover the original vegetation, she says. Downstream from the park, the native willow trees are dense, nearly blocking out sounds from the surrounding neighborhood. Aguiarte says homeless people and deportees used to camp here, but local authorities recently kicked them out so the workers could start restoring the natural environment. We walk through the canyon brush until we reach a barrier of rust-colored thick steel bars, the U.S.-Mexico border fence.
Lo logramos.
Jose Palomera Chavez is one of the workers cleaning out the canyon. He's grateful for the job, but seems somewhat skeptical of his neighbor's will to keep areas like this one clean.
La mera verdad. The
truth, he says, is that the people, we don't do our part. He lives in another canyon that feeds into the Tijuana River Valley, and he says every time the canal at the bottom of his canyon gets cleaned up, it soon fills again with trash. If it doesn't get cleaned up again soon, he says, the rains will bring the trash all the way here to the border. In some ways, this is exactly the point of these binational restoration efforts, to make people like Palomera Chavez aware of how their neighborhoods and actions connect to the larger ecosystem. U.S. border residents can do their part for the Tijuana River at a community cleanup day on October 12th. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
New Mexico has a unique culture of tolerance, especially when it comes to immigration. Nearly half of the state's residents identify as Hispanic or Latino. That strong Hispanic influence has existed for generations, since the Spanish arrived through Mexico. But deportations, which the federal government has stepped up in recent years, reach into communities and families across the state. ICE officially targets criminals in deportation policy, and about 55% of deportations in fiscal year 2012 were for individuals with prior criminal convictions. But there's a clear impact on families left behind. This week, Frontera's desk partner New Mexico in Depth is exploring how the removal of parents and siblings can impact the mental health of young people. In part one, Sarah Gustavus takes us to a special charter school that deals with this on a daily basis.
David Varela is a senior at the South Valley Academy, just outside Albuquerque. He found out last year that his parents and grandmother are all living in the United States without legal status. Now that he knows, David says it's hard to keep it out of his mind.
Like, what would happen with my family if they ever get deported or something? Like, what am I going to do? Where am I going to stay? And I don't know if I could ever survive without them.
This sense of anxiety is realized by many students here. Senior Ingrid Nordonez has a cousin who was deported. She saw his family struggle, and she says some of her friends at school know deportation could change their families too.
Yeah, when they tell me that they're scared of that, they just tell me how they're going to be struggling with the money. They're going to miss their parents.
The South Valley Academy is a farming community. Most students at the academy come from immigrant families. Some were born in the U.S. and are citizens. Others were brought here as children and grew up without legal documentation. The focus of this charter school is college preparation in a mostly low-income area. But life outside the classroom can get in the way, and the staff is ready for that. Teachers and social workers give out their phone numbers to students. Principal Katerina Sandoval says she takes calls at any hour, And some of those calls have to do with the immigration status of students and their families.
I have had on different occasions 5 o'clock in the morning phone calls from students saying, Miss, ICE is here at my trailer. They're beating down my door. Do I let them in?
Researchers estimate 85,000 immigrants live in New Mexico without legal status. It's not as large a population as in Texas or California, but New Mexico only has about 2 million residents, so their presence is very familiar here. School social worker Veronica Romero de Chavez says coping after a parent or family member is deported can take a heavy toll on students.
There's grief, loss, there's depression, and it's situational, and then it's long-term anxiety. Some of those things are manifested through fear and physical pain and headaches, stomach aches.
It affects their ability to do homework. It affects their ability to concentrate on tests.
David Bryant is an English and drama teacher.
It affects the way they interact with their peers in the classroom and discussions, their ability to focus. So it definitely has a huge impact on them.
And Bryant says this means he sometimes has to take on more than what's normally expected of a teacher.
For me, it means that I have to be more of a therapist in the classroom. It means that I have to try to get these emotional needs met first before we can even begin to worry about their academic needs.
He and other staff members often reach out when they can to offer support. Summer Ramos attended the South Valley Academy and now works as a social worker at the new middle school. She says the academy offers students a safe space to talk about immigration concerns.
It's an environment where it's allowed to be spoken about, and they have other people they can relate to. So I think that's helpful in not knowing, okay, well, I'm not alone in this.
The school offers counseling to families and invites in lawyers who can advise parents and young people on applying for deferred action or other relief from deportation, all to try to help keep the students' minds on academics, not immigration status. In Albuquerque, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
There's still more Fronteras coming up, part two of our series about how deportations impact the mental health of young people.
Who am I going to go talk to when I'm sad? Who am I going to go to when I'm scared?
Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Deportations can be examined in numbers. One number, an estimated 200,000 people deported between 2010 and 2012 say they have U.S. citizen children. It's the lasting impact that these deportations have on family members, especially children, who remain in the U.S. that is more challenging to quantify. In our Fronteras desk, partner New Mexico In Depth's second story on this issue, Sarah Gustavus takes us into the home of one teen who's dealing with life after her brother's deportation.
Jackie is quiet and has a big, sweet smile. Growing up, she and her oldest brother were inseparable.
You know, he'd get me out of trouble sometimes, and he would play with me with, like, tea party. He would put his hat on and little tea parties. He was basically my best friend.
The high school junior says people who meet her today aren't getting the real picture of who she is.
Yeah, before my brother was deported, I was more happy and active and with my friends and the teachers. And I wanted to be friends with almost everybody.
3 years ago, her brother was accused of carrying on a sexual relationship with a minor and went to court. Jackie was at her aunt's house when she learned that her brother was detained by immigration officers and would be removed from the U.S.
And I just broke down crying because who am I going to go talk to when I'm sad? Who am I going to go to when I'm scared?
And Jackie was scared. Both of her parents are living in the U.S. without legal status, and her father was detained with her brother. But her father was released from ICE custody because he didn't have a criminal record. Jackie says now she's worried both her parents might be deported. The exact number of immigrant parents deported from the U.S. is unknown, but Congress requested in 2010 that ICE collect data on those deportations. The news site colorlines.com obtained Department of Homeland Security data that indicated over 200,000 individuals who were deported from 2010 through 2012 reported that they had U.S. citizen children. Sarah Nolan is the executive director of an immigrants' rights organization known as CAFE in Las Cruces near the U.S.-Mexico border. She says parents who are vulnerable have created deportation readiness plans, like families who teach their kids how to get out of the house during a fire.
You know, you all run out to the front yard.
And they have an emergency plan for if one or both parents get deported and what happens when they're alone. They have points of contact. They have armed their older children with a rapid response.
Nolan says a parent's deportation is a huge burden on teens. They don't often talk about how they're feeling, but she can tell from what their parents report to her.
Their grades are going down, or they got in trouble at school. They cry a lot, or they just get very quiet.
Younger children may show the stress in different ways, says Angelica Regino, a social worker in the South Valley near Albuquerque.
You know, the adults can tell you exactly how they're feeling. The kids is very different because they don't have those words.
Regino works at Centro Sávila, an organization that offers counseling and other support services to immigrant families. Clients pay by donation. No one is turned away if they don't have insurance or can't afford an hour-long session. This is a unique model that's hard to find anywhere else in New Mexico. The counselors and social workers see children and adults, like John. That's not his real name. John is worried about speaking publicly. He's 24 and says he lived through many stressful years growing up, knowing he or his parents could face deportation.
My mom is constantly worrying. She has plan Bs and plan Cs, and she has money stashed, and depending on what situation, she has different ways to react to him. But my dad he's very brave.
John says his dad doesn't talk openly about his feelings about his immigration status. John didn't either. He kept it all inside until his daughter was born nearly 2 years ago.
Having depression and feeling suicidal, those are not even an option anymore. So I would be hurting her if I did something to me.
John recently became a legal permanent resident, but he's still dealing with the effects of years of anxiety. He says coming to Centro Sávila made a big difference for him. The organization started last year with volunteers and now has 4 staff members. It's growing, but they've recently, reluctantly, had to start a waiting list for new clients. In Albuquerque, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
That story comes to us as part of a collaboration between Fronteras and New Mexico In Depth, online at nmindepth.com. It's been in the works for more than 20 years, but construction has finally begun on the cross-border terminal that will let travelers cross from the Tijuana airport directly into San Diego. From our Fronteras desk, Adrian Florido filed this report.
The Tijuana airport sits up against the international border fence. Many San Diegans traveling to Mexico cross the border to fly out of Tijuana. Bob Lowell and Lori Parks did that recently. They chose Tijuana's airport over San Diego's for a recent trip to Cabo.
So price-wise, it was about 40% cheaper to fly out of here, which seemed totally worth it.
They planned to return on a Sunday, but because that's when many weekend visitors return, I warned them the wait to cross back into San Diego would likely be hours.
Nope. You're not giving me much hope. Isn't the point of this saying it's like an easy thing to do? Like you're talking us out of it right now.
But soon, Parks' problem won't be a problem. Here at the airport, workers are building a 525-foot pedestrian bridge that's going to go right over the border fence and connect to a customs station soon to be built in an empty field on the San Diego side. Airline passengers will be able to cross in both directions.
It has been a very long time coming, but it is very, very welcomed.
Cindy Gomper-Graves directs the South County Economic Development Corporation. Her predecessors first started exploring the feasibility of a cross-border terminal more than 2 decades ago. To find out how many U.S. travelers were using the Tijuana airport, they drove around its parking garage.
Looking at license plates and seeing how many U.S. license plates there were and doing it time and time again, you could figure out an average of about 300,000 people were using the Tijuana airport a year.
They figured they could drive up that number and thus cross-border tourism if they could just cut out the long border waits. That led to some pretty grand ideas, like a terminal that would allow planes to taxi on both sides of the border. The most recent project, though, has been in the works since 2009. It's funded by private U.S. and Mexican investors. They've been gathering the mounds of permits needed to build a bridge spanning 2 countries. They've also been working out other logistics, like how to pay for the customs agents who will be stationed on the U.S. side.
Y nosotros estamos estimando terminar la obra total.
Guillermo Villalba directs the Tijuana airport. He says the cross-border bridge should be done by the middle of next year and operational by the end of the year. the bridge will only be available to ticketed travelers, and they'll have to pay a fee to use it, both of which will ensure a minimal wait to cross the border.
Pero este cruce fronterizo al aeropuerto Tijuana une a dos fronteras.
But Villalba says the bridge is about much more than cutting border wait times. He says it's about sending a message that the border region is prosperous and safe. Indeed, backers plan to use the bridge to attract more business to the border region. Companies like Sony and Sanyo have factories in Tijuana and warehouses in San Diego. They send executives to oversee operations from Asia. The hope is that making it easier to cross the border might attract more of them.
Taxi, San Diego, la línea.
Of course, the project will also have losers. Here, outside the airport, taxi drivers compete for customers. Luis Ramirez says the majority of clients ask to be taken to one of the two existing border crossings. He expects most of that business to be wiped out once the new bridge is complete. That casualty points to a lingering criticism of the cross-border terminal, that it won't really benefit Tijuana. The mayor himself has made this point, saying the benefits to his city aren't clear, since the bridge will give travelers a direct shot into San Diego, allowing them to avoid Tijuana altogether. But Guillermo Villalba, the airport's director, says he's convinced the cost to his city will be far outweighed by the benefits.
Una de ellas es poner a Tijuana en el mapa mundial.
He says the cross-border terminal is going to put Tijuana on the world map, attracting investment, tourism, and economic development that will benefit not only Tijuana, but the state and the entire border region. In San Diego, I'm Adrian Florido.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversations and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thank you for listening.